Folks, you are listening to Yishai and Friends on Israel National Radio. It's good to be with you. You remember yesterday I told you about visiting Merkaz Harav, visiting the library where the eight boys were gunned down, and seeing these little holes in the ground, little dugout trenches made by the Kalashnikov bullet that went through a Jew, took his life away, and then buried itself in the floor of the library or in through the glass, making holes. And I told you that I walked through that library, and just with a kind of sense of awe. You know, sadly, we can walk in that way through a lot of places in the land of Israel, from the streets of Jerusalem, the old city of Jerusalem, Hebron, so many places, Tzfat, so many places. Just wars. We have fought many wars to be here. And we've been killed just for being here, not always able to fight back, like in 1929, Hebron. This fight that we have against evil, against Amalek, is from generation to generation, and certainly as we get closer to the ultimate dream of achieving Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel, creating that temple, being a light unto the nations, the closer we get to achieving that, the more there are things to stop us, to slow us down. And that is why Amalek struck so powerfully against us, killing those eight boys as they were learning Torah. And as I told you before, I think that that terrorist had a clear sense of where he was striking. It was a strategic target, a target where this terrorist set out to destroy those people that might be the Mordechais of this generation, those very people that might give a new direction to what the Jewish state is really all about, right? What we call Neo-Zionism, a renewed sense of what the real Zionism is supposed to be, and not just a defensive doctrine, but instead a destiny doctrine for the Jewish people and for the ingathering of all the exiles. Now, somebody who I've had before on the show, Moise Navon, I've had him talk on the show about Tchelet, because he's highly involved in the Blue String, Blue Fringe. He makes tours, and especially in Pesach and Sukkot. You go into the ocean and you dig, you search out for the snails that make the blue string. But he does that in his spare time. In his professional life, he's a computer engineer, and he's also a rabbinical student at the Merkaz Harav Yeshiva. And he was one floor above, Moise Navon was one floor above the murdered kids, and he heard the rattle of the gunfire. And he had many, many thoughts. And because Moise is also a prolific writer, he wrote an essay that appears on Aish.com right now. And that essay is called Remember Amalek, A Lesson on Divine Providence in Memory of the Fallen Torah Students of Merkaz Harav, Hashem Yinkom Damam. And we have Moise Navon with us today on the show. Moise, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So give us a little play-by-play of what really transpired.
Well,
from your vantage point.
Okay, from my vantage point, basically, I have a shiur every Thursday night. Starts at 7 o'clock and it finishes approximately 8:30. And then we daven arvit, takes whatever that takes, 10, 15 minutes. And then we go down the stairs. As you mentioned, our classroom is one flight above the library. And so we go down the stairs, which are right next to the library, and then go out into the main courtyard. This particular Thursday night, which is relatively rare, we only had 9 people. We normally have at least between 10 to 15 people in the class. And for some reason, we only had 9. And so we went looking for a 10th man. And that 10th man took a good 2 minutes to find.
This is in order to make a prayer quorum.
Correct, correct. So we can't, we could have technically, prayed the evening services, what's known as Beichidut, by ourselves, but it's always much better to pray in a minyan, and so we went searching for this 10th man. And those 2 minutes basically saved our lives, because we would have been in the staircase where, like you just mentioned, that you saw the pockmarks on the floor of the staircase. You know, when we left the building, unfortunately, we had to go over the bodies that those pockmarks were from bullets that went through two yeshiva bachrim.
How was that?
it was very difficult. I mean, we all were basically, that's sort of the end of the story, so I'll just go back to where we were. So we were davening, and then right as we finished davening, the last verse of the Kaddish, where the Chazan says, Oseh Shalom Bimromav, you know, God should make peace in his heavens and make peace for us. Right as he said, God should make peace, we heard machine gun fire.
Automatic or semi-automatic?
Automatic. It was all automatic. As far as I'm not a gun expert, but it was like, you know, major rattling of bullets, one after the other. I believe mm-hmm. that's called automatic.
Right.
At first we really weren't sure because we had just finished praying that it was Rosh Chodesh, you know, the first of the month, and it's Rosh Chodesh Adar.
Could have been firecrackers.
Right. So everybody thought it was firecrackers. But then we heard another blast of automatic fire, and then people began to realize that this wasn't firecrackers, and we all went to the floor, turned the lights off, and began to put the furniture in front of the door. There's basically two doors, so we had two, you know, to block all the doors, and just because none of us were armed at the time, and we held all the furniture against the doors as we just sat there on the floor listening to what was just minutes and minutes and minutes of automatic fire. And as I read in the various posts on the internet, the guy dropped something like 600 bullets, which doesn't sound like an exaggeration to my ears, because, you know, we were sitting there, like I said, literally for minutes with just nonstop gunfire, nonstop. It's just unbelievable that, you know, only 8 people were killed when, you know, after 600 bullets, one could have just imagined how many people he could have killed. In the meantime, so while we were laying there on the floor, we called the police. And the police sort of said, who are you? What is this? They thought it was a prank. They didn't really relate to it in any seriousness.
Really?
And we had to convince them. One of the guy who called said, you know, I'm a doctor in Hadassah. This isn't a joke. There's automatic gunfire in the yeshiva. Send somebody quickly. So then we heard.
What were they thinking?
I don't know. I don't know. You know, who knows? They could think it's a prank. They could think people don't really know what gunfire is. I don't know. In any case, so we did hear actually a siren of one police car, and so we were thinking, wow, that's great. But then later we found out from the news reports that that police car actually didn't bother to come into the yeshiva, but decided to just stop people from coming inside. And so we had to wait for more gunfire and for more deaths to occur. In the meantime,
how long from the initial siren to when the gunfire stopped?
Well, that's what I'm getting to. Actually, from the initial siren till the gunfire stopped was another couple of minutes, but it wasn't due to the police. As I'm sure you're aware, it was due to a guy named Yitzhak Dadon and another guy named Shapira. And that between the two of them, they came in and finished the guy off. I actually watched every move that this guy Yitzhak Dadon did. I saw him coming across the roofs of the yeshiva, crawling and climbing over all kinds of metal fences and gratings until he finally made his way to a little ledge that was directly across from our classroom and directly above the door of the library. And I saw him, you know, lay down on the roof, point his pistol, and I watched him empty his entire cartridge, you know, with fire coming out of the end of his gun until, you know, he dropped the guy.
Wow.
And I saw him also wave to the, basically, after he shot a few times, then he saw this guy Shapira come in, because he waved him and said, Ani Khan, you know, I'm here, and he pointed him below, and then we heard a few more shots, and then that was it, basically. Mm-hmm. Between the two of them, they finished him off.
Mm-hmm.
So then, but then, you know, there were a lot of screaming and a lot of rumors from the screaming that there was maybe another guy. There was another guy with a bomb belt. There was somebody who ran in, out. Nobody really knew what was going on. So we were still bracing for more. Nobody had any idea that it was only one person. So we waited, which I think was like at least another good 10 minutes until all the security forces came. And then, you know, we saw guys in complete riot gear and machine guns and everything, you know, and helmets and bulletproof vests and the whole works, everybody coming in and casing the whole yeshiva. And so we heard them, you know, going through the entire yeshiva, kicking in door by door until they came to ours. And so we knew it was them. We moved the furniture.
Right.
And they came in with guns drawn and flashlights because we had the lights off. And when they saw us, so they also were worried that there's still other people. They immediately got us up and ran us out, and we all, you know, ran out very quickly. We went down the stairs, and then we got to the gory sight that we had to witness at the bottom of the stairs, and we all froze. Just, you know, all of us just, you know, no one had ever seen such a sight, and we froze. And then they said, "Move, move, move, keep going," you know, because again, no one knew what the status of the building was. And so we walked over the bodies, and Hashem Yikom Damam, and we went outside. And then I, you know, after I got out onto the street, I just broke down crying, and I started walking away. You know, I figured, well, I got to go home. You know, I mean, there's nothing to do. The whole streets were closed off, and now there were tons of ambulances coming up. The ambulances, news, police, army, the whole works. And I was like one of the only people that was going in the wrong direction. And so one of the policemen stopped me and said, "Who are you? Where are you going? What happened?" And so I told him the story that I just told you in short. And he said, "Okay, fine, go." And basically that was it. I left, and I was about to get a cab, but it turned out that my daughters were actually in the area, and they had realized that something had happened, and they called me, and so I was able to get a ride home with them, which was fortunate that at least I could be with some of my family and drive home. The drive home turned out to be, you know, longer than usual because of all the roadblocks that were set up afterwards. So it took us like 3 hours to do what you normally takes like 20, 25 minutes to mm-hmm. do. But during that time, so it gave me a lot of time to think. And, I mean, beyond the gory scenes and the terrible tragedies that one can only imagine afterwards, that we realized how terrible everything was, because really we didn't have any idea what the outcome was. The only thing that kept going through my mind was, you know, how could this happen? How could it happen in a yeshiva while the guys were learning Torah? You know, there's so many...
So a theological problem started occurring to you.
Right, right.
You weren't thinking about politics. You weren't thinking about, you know, how could he have gotten in, about, you know, security. You immediately went to a kind of a religious framework of questioning.
Absolutely. There's really, I mean, there wasn't
so
any
what's the
point.
Question? What's the question?
Well, the point is, I mean, it's the classic question of tzaddik v'ralo, you know, how can bad things happen to good people? But for me, it was magnified, you know, infinitely by the fact that these guys were in the middle of learning Torah. And they were, you know, in a yeshiva, learning Torah, Torah students that had dedicated themselves at least for this amount of time to learn Torah, and how could such a thing happen? And of course, you know, I should preface it, there are never really any, ultimately there's no answer. I mean, this is the question, you know, the theodicy is a question that has plagued man, or at least religious man, ever since he began to believe in God. But nevertheless, we all struggle with it and try to come up with some kind of answers. Although, of course, we'll never really know the answer until we get to the other side, to the world of truth.
So how did you, what did you come up with?
Well, I mean, you know, basically there's a couple answers. One answer, of course, is that man has free will. And in order for man to exercise his free will, he has to be in an environment where there's the choice between good and bad. And so there is evil. There's evil in the world, and man is in charge of it. And it's our duty, as part of the completion of creation, to try and rid the world of this evil. And so that's one of the answers. And then, and as sort of a corollary to that, but why didn't God do anything? And so God cannot, as it were, his hands are sort of tied in the sense that if he does step in for us, so he's basically taken away our free will. And he's taken away that one little bit of responsibility to complete creation. This is our greatest task, and it's our, you know, it shows that God has hope for us, that we can actually do something of significance. And that significance is eradicating evil from the world. And so...
Also, I think that to say that God didn't do something is you know, we cannot see God's full picture. He may
right.
very well, as you said, he emptied 600 bullets, and yet 8 people were killed. Meaning to say, it could have been much, much worse.
So
you have to give God credit. You don't really know, you know, where he begins and ends in his actions.
Right, right. And in that sense, I because of that reason, I said the traditional prayer afterwards, thanking God for saving me. Even though, you know, I said it with tears in my eyes, and it's very difficult to thank God for saving me while these other 8. Pure souls were taken.
You know, if that gun would have been pointed upwards, it wouldn't be far-fetched for a bullet to go through the floor. Those bullets can go through amazing chunks.
I'm not sure. I really don't know. I mean, I know that, like I said, because of the timing, we were saved, and otherwise we would have been on those stairs.
What else? What else helps you cope and understand?
Well, what else helps me is that... that really even the Zohar which goes through great lengths to explain the greatness of the Torah learning and how it serves as a protection for somebody against all kinds of things. Nevertheless, even the Zohar itself says that nobody can go around and say, I'm going to do good and I can expect that God is going to save me from anything. No one can guarantee themselves that. We all have to try, and the Zohar says we have to try as best we can to learn Torah, to do good deeds, to complete creation and bring peace to the world. But just because we do our best to do that, does not provide any guarantee. What it does provide is that, in general, it will help us, and who knows when and what in what ways what merits help somebody throughout the world.
But, well, there's a guarantee for our nation.
That's correct.
Right.
Correct.
The nation has survived the worst of the worst, right. And have survived for 3,000 years with unlike any other nation in the world. So it's clear that the nation has a protection.
Right.
But sometimes individuals don't. But I want to tell you that great Kabbalists have already said in the last few days that these young boys were some kind of offering, they went up, and some people have said, "Bekrovaya Kaddish, with my close ones, do I?"
Right, 100%. I mean, the thing is, that's another Kabbalistic idea which the Zohar brings and explains that they're tzaddikim, very righteous people, and children who learn Torah. The Tinokocho Beit Rabban, it's called. That these children who learn Torah specifically. They provide some kind of an atonement for the sins of the generation. And then the Zohar continues and says that if by in their life that they don't provide enough atonement, then God himself takes them from the world, even though, and it says, there is no sin in them. So this is a Kabbalistic idea which, some people can find comfort in and some people may not be able to accept.
But. What about Purim? What about Purim Adar?
So Purim, the fact of the matter is, what's really very interesting in a theological sense is the timing of this event, that it occurred on Rosh Chodesh Adar, and that Adar is really the time where we celebrate the victory over Amalek, but that victory came at a price. I mean, there was a person by the name of Haman who threatened to destroy all the Jews, and there was a war before there was a celebration. And the fact of the matter is that Amalek is this people that represents evil, that represents going against all societal norms and all norms of morality in order to further their cause. And the verse says that they feared not God. Yoram Chazoni says something very interesting. How do we identify Amalek? He says that Amalek has three specific features. They attack the weak, they attack the defenseless, and they attack without any recourse to any kind of rules of society, of any kind of norms of morality. They fear not God, the verse says. And in the Tanakh, when it says, Lo yira Elohim, that they're not God-fearing, it doesn't mean in the sense of doing mitzvot. It means in the sense of accepting some natural societal norms of morality.
Right.
And that's what Amalek does. They go and attack children learning Torah. They go and attack people in a market. They go and shoot a mother and her daughters just driving on the road.
Right.
They've gone beyond all they've broken every rule of society. And Yoram Chazoni in his book The Dawn, which I highly recommend as an interpretation of the Megillah, explains there that basically they represent the rule that crime pays, as opposed to the Jews, who represent the rule that crime does not pay. That ultimately,
that's interesting.
Yes, doing good and doing right will come to perfect the world, and the opposite will come to destroy it.
Moise, one thing that struck me, I think it's a theological thing, because you just said it in a theological sense, which is that there's a fight against Amalek. And on a practical level, it's like Jewish people, the one lesson that we learned in the Holocaust, the non-theological, common-sense lesson is Jews must defend themselves. And one of the principal things of this country when it was established was the right to self-defense. Now, people poo-poo it, especially in the national religious world. They say, well, that's not a complete picture. Really, we're here for destiny. But I think that the kasha has got to be given to the people who represent kind of the establishers of the State of Israel, saying, where's that defense? Where's that essential defense? And a person, I, for example, am a proud gun carrier.
Right.
And I don't hide it inside, my shirt or anything like that. Why? Because I believe that after years and years and years of being in foreign countries, not having the right to bear weapons, which is a human right, you know, which is a, maybe an essential civil right to protect oneself. It's not an issue of being able to carry weapons, it's an issue of being able to protect oneself. And to me here, what happened was also, on top of all the theological things, a very plain lesson, which is Jews, and you pointed out, who is the one who took these people out? Civilians, right?
Right, right.
Civilians protected protected fellow Jews. We have to protect one another.
No, I agree 100%. We need to protect ourselves. There's no question. But I think that the fight against Amalek, this should definitely be stressed, is a national fight.
Right.
Right. And it's just not going to do any individual any good to go and try and find, you know, who is Amalek. Really,
right.
it's a national battle, and the Jews as a Jewish people, as a nation, have to decide that there's an enemy against us, and we need to fight them and as such, because they're fighting us.
I have 2 minutes left, but
sure.
You told me that it raised the ire, or at least the eyebrows, of some professors abroad, this theory of yours that this gunman was, in fact, you know, an Amalekite.
Right, right. So what I'd like to sort of emphasize here is that, you know, Amalek, at least according to many commentators, if it's Rav Hirsch or Rav Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rav, that basically Amalek represents an ideal. I think that we can sort of trade the word Amalek with the word terrorist. They're people, like I said, who attack the weak and defenseless and pay no heed to any moral conventions. Anybody who fights in that way, which today in modern parlance basically is a terrorist, falls into the category of Amalek. And that's not to say that, you know, we have a mitzvah to eradicate Amalek. I think that mitzvah means to eradicate terrorism, to eradicate people who have gone beyond all moral norms of society. And again, there's a quote of the Rambam who says that if these people will accept upon them the norms of civil society, the seven mitzvot of Bnei Noach, so then we accept them. We don't have any, you know, we don't have any issues to.
It's not
to
a
destroy
racist
them.
Issue,
right?
It's not a racist issue. It's
no,
a moral issue.
It's a moral issue. It's a moral issue that terrorism is plaguing all of the modern world, and it has to be eradicated. We put that in the phraseology of the Bible as eradicating Amalek. I don't see it as being this sweeping, very difficult issue to understand. The whole world is talking about the war against terrorism, and we phrase it in the terms of eradicating Amalek, and we celebrate, as we should, Bezrat Hashem, this Purim, we should celebrate the eradication of terrorism and this evil scourge that's destroying modern society.
Moise Navon, thank you very much for being with us, and you're, of course, highly involved in Tchelet, the Tchelet Revolution, as I like to call it.
Yeah.
And you're also a computer engineer working on the fanciest computer chips that are going to make the world a safer place.
Correct.
Being put in cars and different things. And you also write a lot of interesting philosophical and halachic issues. And you can find more of Moise Navon's commentary at Divrei, D-I-V-R-E-I, Navon, N-A-V-O-N.com, which means words of thoughts of wisdom, of
Correct.
Navon is like smartness.
Right.
Moise Navon, we're glad that you made it through it, and may God avenge the blood of those who were killed.
Amen. Thank you so much, Yishai.
Thank you for being with
Be
us.
Well.
You are listening to Yishai and Friends on Israel National Radio. Important stuff to understand the depth of this world. We will not forget. We will not forgive. Stay tuned. More great stuff is on the way.